Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, June 25th, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing today's U.S. Supreme Court Obamacare decision. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to have brief opening remarks from each of our three experts today, followed by a little back and forth, and then your questions. We should have plenty of time for questions at the end. We'll hear first from Professor Josh Blackman. He's a professor at the South Texas College of Law. He's also the author of the upcoming book, Unraveled, Obamacare, Religious Liberty, and Executive Power. That's due out in 2016, I believe. He'll be followed by Professor Jonathan H. Adler. He's the Johann Verhey Memorial Professor of Law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. And then we'll hear from David B. Rivkin, Jr., partner at the Baker & Hostetler Law Firm right here in Washington, D.C. I think all of them are return guests who teleform, so welcome back, gentlemen. With that, the floor is yours, Professor Blackman.
Okay, thank you, Dean, and thank you, everyone, to Federal Society. So today we're talking about the decision in King v. Burwell, and I'm sure most people are familiar with the facts, but if not, I'll summarize them briefly. This case considered whether the Affordable Care Act, and the statute says that subsidies are available in exchange established by the states, whether those subsidies can be paid out on a federal exchange. The long and tortured history of this case doesn't need to be summarized. Suffice to say that the court took this case last fall, when there actually wasn't much of a circuit split, raising questions whether there were enough votes to perhaps reverse. Today, we have the decision by a vote of 6-3. It was, again, Chief Justice Roberts voting to basically save the Affordable Care Act. And the decision is important for a couple reasons. So first of all, the Chief Justice basically rejected the Solicitor General's argument that this was some sort of term of art that established by the state meant something. Also, the Chief Justice rejected this federalism argument, which has been bandied about. Ilya Soman knows this on Volokh today. That got nowhere. Also significant, the Chief Justice pointed out that this is not really a question of Chevron, right? The IRS isn't an agency in the healthcare business, and they shouldn't have even been delegated the authority to make this rule. Rather, this job falls to the Article III courts, and that's where the opinion goes downhill very quickly. Okay. So the reason why this opinion, I think, will strike many as difficult was the number of hoops that the court had to jump through to get to the final answer. Justice Scalia points out in his dissent that if you can find ambiguity in a statute that says established by the state, you can find ambiguity anywhere. And specifically, the Chief Justice goes through all these various ambiguities that could be raised. Well, if you interpret it this way, then there may be some exchanges with no people on them. If you interpret it that way, there may be this and that. And at every single turn, Justice Scalia says, well, this is a 900-page bill with lots of things that don't make sense. There are lots of ambiguities, but you can't read these external ambiguities to make it the actual text is nullified. As Justice Scalia points out, the phrase established by the state is written seven times. So basically in seven places, the Chief Justice has struck out words from the statute. But I think the more troubling implication of the case has to do with the fact that the Chief Justice makes a lot about this death spiral business. He keeps saying over and over again that the purpose of the Affordable Care Act is to improve healthcare markets, quote, not to destroy them. If at all possible, we must interpret the act in a way that's consistent with the former and avoid the latter. Okay? So in other words, Obamacare is not just a law anymore, right? It's this free-ranging license to expand and improve healthcare at all costs. And when you start taking that posture, when you view that the ruling against the government here would take away subsidies from people, it basically makes Obamacare untouchable. It's some sort of super statute that is beyond reach. And President Obama said that as much today when he said that 5 years in, what we're talking about is no longer just a law. The president said this. He says you can't unravel the fabric of what's been woven to the American people. You can't undo this. Justice Scalia makes the powerful rejoinder. The only reason why we would have this calamity is because of the IRS rule in the first place. Had the IRS never actually created this rule, probably all 50 or probably 47 or 48 states would have built exchanges. And as a result, we wouldn't have had this problem. The only reason we have this problem is because of this executive action in the first place to promulgate this rule. The Chief Justice's decision is residing in some sort of dream world once again, where what's fair is foul, what's foul is fair. A penalty is actually a tax, and a state's actually the federal government. And only by jumping through these, quote, somersaults, to paraphrase from Justice Scalia, we reach the conclusion that the government wins in this case. I think the court's also sending a signal saying, we're done with this. By taking this case now, when there were only apparently three votes to reverse, mean at least one judge in the majority voted for certiorari. You need four votes for cert. So at least one justice voted for cert who ultimately voted to uphold the law. Why was this done? Well, maybe a justice changed his mind. Maybe he was persuaded. Or perhaps they said, let's get this over with now before 2016 so we don't have to deal with this in a presidential election. I don't know quite what to deal with that, but it's a very disconcerting opinion of what this court means. I'm going to stop here and turn it over to my friend Jonathan Adler, who is deserves a lot of credit. He and Michael Cannon took great steps to advance a theory of this case, and I look forward to hearing what Jonathan has to say.
Thank you, Josh. A disappointing opinion today by the Chief Justice, showing that he is not a textualist, and also in many respects showing that his commitment to minimalism is not as great as he would like. It's as if in certain respects the umpire thinks it's okay to pinch hit if necessary to ensure the proper outcome. The case is obviously a significant victory for the Obama administration, and I agree with much of what Josh said. It's a loss for textualist approaches to statutory interpretation. Textualism had appeared to be on something of an upswing in recent years, but this case certainly pushes it back against that quite strongly, holding that not only is ambiguity to be found quite readily, but that specific language used by Congress, even whereas here that language is added in repeated places at multiple times during the drafting process, that such language need not be given any meaning at all when interpreting the statute. It's also in some interesting ways a loss for the Chevron doctrine. So in my view, this is, while a win for Obama in some respects, it's a double loss for Justice Scalia, because two of the things that he has been a fierce advocate of, both textualism and an expansive Chevron doctrine, or expansive application of the Chevron doctrine, both took a hit today. There are ways in which this decision by the chief is somewhat reminiscent of his dissent in the City of Arlington versus FCC case. I have some sympathies for the Chief Justice's dissent in that other case. I just don't have the confidence that this case, the decision in King, represents a majority for anything more than the precise outcome here, as opposed to a majority for a more constrained view of Chevron. That is to say, although the court for the court to reach its decision in favor of the administration, Chief Justice Roberts says that the apparent conflict between the text and the purpose and structure of the statute renders the statute ambiguous. Normally, under Chevron, that would mean the court defers to the agency lets the agency resolve the ambiguity, but the Chief Justice says that can't be done here because of the magnitude of the question at issue, and so instead the court will take it upon itself to resolve the ambiguity and do so, as Josh already noted, not based on adhering to the text that Congress wrote, but instead adhering to the court's construction of what the court believes the statute was meant to do and how that structure was supposed to operate. In that respect, the court is narrowing the scope of Chevron and certainly giving plaintiffs in future cases the ability to argue that their questions or their issues raise the sorts of questions that should escape from Chevron. A couple quick comments on some of the practical implications of this case. One, I do think that lower courts will read this case as a reason to be skeptical of other implementation challenges to the statute. So I think this case, although it did not rely upon Chevron, will have the practical effect of giving the executive branch greater license in implementing the statute. It will not, however, end Obamacare litigation. Supreme Court has a Clean Air Act case this term, and the Clean Air Act was last revised 25 years ago. The Affordable Care Act is more complicated, more poorly written, and puts more at stake than the Clean Air Act does. As a consequence, we'll see ACA litigation for decades to come. If the chief thought he was somehow putting an end to it, he's in for a rude awakening. There will be many more cases, and this statute will be up and before the Supreme Court time and time again. The other somewhat ironic practical effect of this decision is it makes clear to states that they have very little reason to run their own exchanges. A lot of states have had difficulty running their own exchanges. It's costly. It's an administrative nightmare. This statute removes any negative consequence of a state giving up running its own exchange. So I would not be at all surprised if, going forward, we see states begin to turn their exchanges back over to the federal government. And the real irony of that, of course, is that in the Senate, as the Affordable Care Act was being drafted and debated, its supporters repeatedly said that this statute would not result in a federal takeover of health insurance markets. And the primary basis for making that argument that, for example, the Senate Democratic Policy Committee made was that all exchanges would be run by the federal government, or sorry, all exchanges would be run by the states, not by the federal government. Not only is that not what has happened under the Affordable Care Act, it is certainly not what will happen going forward as a result of this decision. I'll stop there and turn it over to David.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'll say first that I agree pretty much with everything that my good friends, Josh and Jonathan, said a few points. I'm quite depressed by this decision. Let's forget about how three of us were handicapping it in advance, but I would say that it's, in my opinion, the first point I'm going to make is worse than the rewrite of Obamacare in an NFIB litigation. Briefly to explain why, in both instances you have Article III, of interpreting the law, in effect acting as an exercise of legislative power, which of course violates horizontal separation of powers and is quite a bad thing. So this decision is no worse in that respect. But I would say, at least as far as what was involved policy-wise, there is an argument to be made that the demise of individual mandate would have truly created Obamacare. Now, I'm not saying it to justify the chief's rewrite of individual mandate as a tax, but merely to say that it was done in the context of some arguably robust policy arguments. The thing that upsets me here is that the notion that loss of access to subsidies by 6 to 7, 8 million people, however, whatever is the number involved, really would not have had any discernible impact on what's been called colloquially death spiral or destabilization of insurance markets. The reason for it briefly is because the death spiral, slash destabilization of insurance markets is driven by the fact that you don't have enough so-called young invincible folks who basically pay the premiums but partake little of any health care. And there have been a lot of studies which show that individuals in the category are not buying health insurance in sufficient numbers, and that decision is not particularly price elastic. So even if some of them have access to subsidies, they would not buy it. And they're not buying it because they're young invincibles. The name says it all. They just don't think they need it now. So the fact that the key policy argument that's been used here by the court is completely untenable underscores that not only constitutionally prescribed for the courts to exercise legislative power, but they're singularly bad at doing that. The second point as to why this is worse, despite Jonathan's point about the city of Arlington and the chief dissent there and the trimming the reach of Chevron, I don't disagree with that point. But to me, it's as important as administrative law is to all of us. I don't think that it makes the chief's opinion in some ways more redeeming than could have been the alternative. And of course, as you may all recall, the speculation, among other reasons, why the chief rewrote the individual insurance purchase mandate and NFIB was that he would be able to cap their opinion in a way that mitigated the damage and had lots of hortatory praises for the concept of limited enumerated powers in general and the cabining of the Commerce Clause, necessary and proper clause. So I see no such redeeming virtue here, despite the point about the city of Arlington and the proper reach of Chevron. I'm frankly quite puzzled that the chief made the statement here, because in some sense it indicates to everybody that they really did it on their own. They're not deferring to anybody. My other point here would be to say this. This is not only a bad decision from the horizontal separation of powers perspective, but it's a very bad decision from the vertical separation of powers perspective, to elaborate. I always believe that the reason the availability of subsidies was language was drafted in the way that pivoted off language in exchange established by the state is because of anti-commandeering principles. You could not directly mandate that states would have set up their own exchanges. That would have violated the teaching of New York and Prince. And yet everybody understands that that Congress and the executive were highly desirous of having the states run insurance exchanges. Not surprising if you remember the mess with the federal exchange and the infamous website, et cetera, et cetera. But that's kind of an obvious point. A less obvious point, I'd like to think, that sorry, I skipped one point. So Congress chose, in a way, to come up with a usual bribe, which how lots of cooperative federalism statutes work, particularly in the context of a spending power. You tell the states, you regulate according to what I tell you to regulate. I cannot commandeer you. I cannot coerce you, but I'm going to give you a lot of money. I'm going to give you a lot of money. I'm going to give a lot of money to your citizens. So it was done for good and sufficient reasons. Now, the flip side of that, of course, the states consistent with federalism principles have an opportunity to say no to that bribe, not only because they did not want to spend resources running insurance exchanges, but remember, one of the consequences here, aside from whether or not you like Obamacare in general, is that the insurance employer mandate, is effectively disabled in states that did not run their own exchanges. And even the individual insurance purchase mandate, while not completely disabled because of a limitation, 8% of income limitation on who is subject to the mandate is capping the bit. So you can look at this provision not as some drafting error, not as something that is inconsistent with the broader goals of Congress in the context of Obamacare, but as Justice Scalia points out in his excellent dissent, as reflecting the important congressional goal of having states run their own exchanges. And what I'm adding to this is the notion that it was perfectly constitutionally appropriate from a federalism perspective to entrust those choices to the states. So having the court rewrite this language violated simultaneously both horizontal and vertical separation of powers, no particular redeeming policy goal in sight. So it's all quite depressing. Let me stop here and we'll go to questions. Dean?
Thank you very much, gentlemen. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone if you have a question. Once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We'll try to get to as many questions as possible. We've got about over 300 listeners, so I'm going to ask folks to be as concise as possible with their questions. And before we begin with that, just a reminder about our upcoming schedule of Teleform conference calls. It is a fluid schedule. The court will decide still more cases tomorrow and on Monday, and our Teleform schedule will depend on exactly what the court does. For those of you who are wondering about the Texas housing case, which came out today, we do plan to do a Teleform conference call on that decision just as soon as we can get to it in our schedule. Today, of course, it's all about the Affordable Care Act case. We've got, it looks like, about 8 or so questions to begin with. Once again, please be as concise as possible with your questions, and we'll get to as many of them as possible. Let's take our first call.
Yes, this is Mark Schumann. I'm in practice in New York City. Thank you for the presentations. Question for you. I wonder, you touched upon the discussion of Chevron in this opinion. Is there anything to be said for the blow that the Chief Justice's opinion struck at Chevron, its use more generally in administrative law, or is it likely to be a dead letter outside of this context?
I'll just jump in there. I think the Chief Justice believes he's doing that. There is some parallel between his analysis of why Chevron is inapplicable here and the arguments he made in his dissent in the City of Arlington case, which was another case in which I had submitted an amicus and liked his opinion more. The problem is that there's no reason to believe that the other justices, with the possible exception of Justice Kennedy, who had joined his opinion today, really care that much about the scope of Chevron, and there's no reason to believe they will feel bound by the hints of limiting Chevron in this case. His reliance on cases like FDA versus Brown and Williamson, I think, is suggestive of that point. FDA versus Brown and Williamson is a case that the Supreme Court tends to cite when it's departing from traditional norms of administrative law, and its adherence to FDA versus Brown and Williamson has been sporadic. I think giving the Chief Justice the benefit of the doubt, I think he figures that by not deferring to the IRS, he is in some way constraining the administrative state, narrowing the range of questions that agencies get deference on. But I don't think that there's enough in the opinion to create a real doctrine there or to create a real test for lower courts to decide when Chevron should apply and when it shouldn't, and I don't expect that the current court will see the need to apply that approach very consistently. So I'm not convinced there's a major silver lining for future administrative law cases.
Josh Blackman or David Ritkin, anything on this point?
Well, briefly, because again, in my view, it's an elegant point, but does not compare in significance what else at stake. It's interesting to me that the issue, as Jonathan knows well, in the City of Arlington was whether or not determinations by agencies that they have jurisdiction are entitled to Chevron deference or should be reviewed de novo. The way I read the Chief's discussion of why he's not deferring to IRS is a little different. It's more a question of IRS's lack of expertise on this issue. So it's kind of somewhat, to me, in a different plane than the issue in the City of Arlington. But as I said, I would not fall on my sword on this. I think it's such a depressing decision that I'm not inclined to see any redeeming virtues here.
Let's take another question.
This is David Applegate with the Chicago Lawyers Chapter. Several years ago, in the wake of the GM bankruptcy, Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, Judge Richard Posner expressed the view that rule of law meant that a judge could not decide a case for General Motors because he owned General Motors stock. Other than that, he said, a federal judge had pretty much unlimited power and can do what he wanted. Was Judge Posner being too cynical in the opinion of the speakers, or have we reached the point now at which that's an accurate description, the recent 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta notwithstanding?
So this is Josh. I'll start with this one. I think the anniversary of Magna Carta is very salient because what we have here is a situation of the federal government's own making. They rushed a statute through that no one read. It included language that perhaps no one even realized was there, except for a few people, perhaps. And then when it didn't work out the way they wanted, they used executive power to try and fix it. By using that fix, they basically altered how the state decided to elect to establish exchanges or not. As a result, 3 years later, we're now in the position where if the subsidies were taken away, it would create a calamity, perhaps. Okay? All this happened because at each step, they rushed through the legislative process and used executive power to try and bypass what Congress had actually done. Today, the Supreme Court blesses this. And the words of Justice Scalia in the dissent, it encourages, quote, lassitude. It makes Congress even lazier and delegates to the Leviathan in Washington all its authority to make statutes that Congress didn't. From beyond anything else, this is a rule of law issue. And I wrote an amicus brief on behalf of Cato, drawn by Ilya Shapiro, that makes a very similar point. This is a rule of law issue more than anything else.
Let me just add briefly that Josh and I may disagree a little bit, perhaps, as to whether or not the language that limited availability of subsidies to individuals who purchased insurance policies in exchanges dealt with by the states was a result of inadvertence, or as I suggested, a result of a strategic choice of wanting to have the states drive us for a variety of reasons, but not being able to quote them directly, lest it violates anti-commandeering principles. But leaving that point aside, I certainly endorse the product conclusion. In fact, I would say that the sad reality here is that it's not just a question of encouraging a lassitude or, careless drafting. It fundamentally provides a safety valve for both political branches, both Article 1 and Article 2. Why should they write statutes that make clear choices that are going to hurt somebody and benefit somebody and be held accountable, because accountability is one of the key virtues, constitutional virtues, to be driven from the separation of powers. You can rely on individuals who are completely insulated from accountability by virtue of only life tenure to fix the statute as needed. Now you can say, well, why does it make sense? Because this interpretation was propounded by the executive branch. But at the end of the day, once the court endorses it, particularly when they say it's really boldly, it is really our job to do that, to save a statute for itself. In effect, it all becomes their responsibility. So we have a long-term path there that essentially transfers power from both political branches towards Article III, diminishes accountability, diminishes democracy, and it's just, I cannot... I'm repeating myself. I cannot tell you how horrible I think this is.
Thank you for that excellent summation.
Let's carry on and check in with another caller.
Thank you, Dean. This is Roger Pilon at Cato. I want to pick up on a couple of points that John Adler just touched upon relating to. It seems to me that this is something of a perverse blend of the opposing positions of activism and restraint from a few decades ago. On the one hand, to a fault, the court today is deferential to the political branches, much like Bickle and Bork urged. But on the other hand, you've got manifesting itself in the kind of liberal activism that we saw from Brennan, sort of rewriting the statute to save Congress from itself. So I wonder, John, if you
want to
elaborate a little bit on that.
Well, I think the Chief Justice has a conception of the court that I think was defined in kind of an opposition to the Warren and Burger court, the idea that the court plays too large a role on the public stage. And the Chief Justice, like many conservative lawyers of his generation, thought the answer to that was to be very minimalistic and very deferential. The problem is that that cat is out of the bag. The court is called upon to answer lots of questions that maybe 100 years ago it might not have been called upon to answer. And the truly minimalist approach to that is to apply clear, predictable rules in a predictable fashion, such that lower courts know how cases should be resolved, and both the political branches and the private litigants know how cases should be resolved. And that requires, for example, in the context of statutory interpretation, not imagining what hypothetical Congress might have done had it had the chance to write a statute differently, or not imagining what their purpose would have been if they had anticipated, as no member of Congress did, that 36 states would not create their own exchanges. And so the Chief Justice is kind of created a bind of his own making. On the one hand, he apparently doesn't want to write a decision that could have the practical effect of exposing the Affordable Care Act's costs and weaknesses, and have the practical effect of, at least until Congress intervenes, cutting off subsidies for millions of Americans that were not authorized by the statute. But the only way he can do that is by, in effect, rewriting the statute, as I put it at the beginning of the call, transitioning from umpire to pinch hitter. And we saw an aspect of that in NFIB. What's interesting is that in prior cases where we've seen this sort of behavior from the chief, it's usually arisen because of concerns about constitutional avoidance. Rewrite the statute in NFIB and Bond versus United States in the first Voting Rights Act case. In according to at least some press reports, the draft opinion the Chief Justice initially circulated in Citizens United, rewrite the statutes in those cases so as to avoid having to strike something down constitutionally. And the argument there would be, well, if the court holds something to be unconstitutional, that really ties the political branch's hands. Let's give them a chance to fix it first. There's no such justification for the Chief Justice's approach here, because upholding the plain language of the text of the statute would not in any way tie Congress's hands or prevent the political branches from responding the way the political branches are supposed to respond when a statute doesn't quite work out the way some people hoped. I do think that this decision does require us it's going to require me to reconsider a little bit the way I had evaluated and described the Chief Justice's jurisprudence up to this point. And I think it should make us understand the Chief Justice's project differently, because it's certainly not what he had led us to believe it was. And it will not, decisions like this will not result in the court having a smaller role in political life. It's rather an invitation to bring the court further into debates over policy.
And this is Josh, if I can add briefly. There was one point during oral argument where Justice Scalia asked the Solicitor General, can't Congress change this law? And the Solicitor General replied back with some snark, this Congress, as if, could it be conceivable that Congress would actually fix this law? Chief Justice Roberts' opinion makes it pretend as if nothing can happen after this decision. There's nothing Congress could conceivably do. And Justice Scalia says, why can't Congress fix it? Or why can't Congress leave it? John is exactly right. This creates a bigger role for the courts to rewrite statutes and actually decreases the incentive for Congress to actually write precise statutes or fix things. So now all of it falls to Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy.
Right. This is David Rifkin. I agree with everything that's been said by Justice Donovan. Just to add a couple of points. And Roger, in his question, used the word deference. I actually would kind of push back against it. Of course, the administration here, the executive branch, in this case, propounded the position that the court ultimately embraced. But let's have a small thought experiment. Let's imagine we had a different administration that was not particularly keen on Obamacare and interpreted the subsidy provision that was written. And you had individuals that would have standing, arguing that they were deprived of this statutorily granted boon. I'm not sure that, at least as a philosophical matter, we would not have had the same decision. So I don't see much deference here to any of the political branches. So I don't see it as only the court partaking of legislative power. I think the court partaking of political power. My second point, and a depressing one is let's talk for 2 seconds about the real elephant in the room. I happen to think that in both NFIB case and this case, at least some of the justices acted the way they've done because of political pressure. That was rather, shall we say, robust for media statements by the administration. And if that is true, that introduces a very dangerous paradigm, given the nature of our mainstream media and the society we live in. So we have even the best possible nominees chosen by Republican presidents who come in. Everybody expects them to uphold the Constitution, to apply a proper judicial function, construe statutes as written. They come under pressure from the institutions in society that are very much outcome-driven and they create her. And that's bad enough. I'm not suggesting that it's great for Article 3 to create in response to any political pressures. But think about their symmetry. The liberal justices are not only not coming under that pressure, because by and large, there's not many institutions in society that are able to bring it to bear, but I also think they would be more resilient to it. So it is in kind of a note of real pessimism as to what we can expect as far as the judicial decisions in very sensitive cases, even if we were to improve, of course, current balance by virtue of having an ex-Republican president. So I don't mean to depress everybody, but just wanted to share my angst here.
This is Dean Royer. Let me ask a question about the way the court reached its decision. Let's assume, as you were just postulating, David Rivkin, that there is an ex administration. It's not favorably disposed to the Affordable Care Act. Would a subsequent IRS be able to change this rule and sort of move things in a backward direction, or is that close given the way
Briefly, not really, in part because, as the points made earlier by Jonathan about the fact that this is really not a Chevron case. No,
right.
The court has clearly articulated for itself a very bold position of, in effect, being able to save a statute. That is a very important statute. If it was some technical matter dealing with patent law or perhaps bankruptcy, they wouldn't have done it. So it's not for all statutes. And by the way, I don't think it's unique to Obamacare. There certainly can be similar statutory exercises in the future. The court articulated a role for itself as kind of a platonic guardian of making statutes work in accordance with what they believe to be incorrectly, by the way, my musings about the reason why this language was there, what they believe to be preferences of Congress. And I think they might be able, especially with strong political pressure coming from mass media and various other institutions, they would be able to achieve the same result, Dean, to be precise in answering your question, in a Republican administration that's trying to cabin some of those exercises, which is very depressing. It makes the problem long-term and not confined to a particular period in our political history, which makes it worse.
We've got plenty of questions pending. Let's take another call now.
Hi, Eric Clays, George Mason Law. I have a question. I think it's provoked by some of Jonathan's points about Chevron in the first question. Assume that another administration decided later that it wanted to rescind the federal exchanges. Under this opinion, could that I know this is hypothetical. It's not going to happen in the real world. But if some administration were to try to do so, under this opinion, would it have statutory authority to do so?
I do not believe so. I mean, the implications, two things. One, the statute puts an obligation on the federal government to create exchanges if states either don't create their own exchanges or don't meet other requirements. I didn't see anything in the opinion that in any way makes that obligation anything other than a firm legal obligation. And then the consequence of taking this out of Chevron, the court says expressly, this is not a question for the IRS. So there is no, according to this Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, the IRS has not been delegated the authority to resolve this question. Rather, the statute, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, resolves this question. It has been resolved once and for all. So there is no brand X ability to switch. It is resolved now and forever. At least that's certainly how I read it.
We're in the court, just to get a technical point. If the next administration were to try to de-establish federal exchanges, I can envision the possibility of a lawsuit arguing the administration failed to perform a non-discretionary duty. So
we haven't had those that way.
It would certainly succeed, at least at the Supreme Court level.
Let's take another call now.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. In looking over this case, it does seem there might be ways that the arguments could have been better made in briefs, both by parties and amici, with a view to how this interpretation turned out and to avoid it in the future if we're going forward. The majority seems to be assuming that Congress has some will, common will, to provide health care, as opposed to, say, a will that to avoid providing health care in a way that would draw heat on them for denying it to individuals that they can't afford to provide it to, and to do instead to shift the costs and, of course, the profits, like in the case of insurance companies, off onto the states or the insurance companies. Now, in fact, to make them the death panels. So that's a cynical interpretation of Congress's intent, but I think that there's plenty of evidence to support that interpretation, and if there had been a more evidentiary component to the argument made in this case, that might have been persuasive.
Well,
who wants to respond?
Let me try to defend that in his defense. My good friend Mike Carvin and others have litigated this case. Given how compelling the interpretation of a statutory language is, it didn't seem to be much need to be talking about Rorschach tests, like what was Congress's main intent, secondary intent, tertiary intent. That in some ways it just would not have been useful. What I said earlier in this call about the reason was chosen because that's the only way in which Congress could try in accordance with traditional spending laws, cooperative federalism legislation, bribe the states. This is all kind of loosey-goosey, and it's not easy to, especially given the way in which Obamacare was enacted. I cannot tell you if there's a specific reference in some committee report or some hearing that took place. So I think it's a little unfair to say that it was argued differently. It would have been better. And frankly, let me be cynical. I don't think, no matter how well this case could have been argued, I think it was argued perfectly well, it would not have made any difference. This is the problem. Once you take a position that is essentially designed to bring about a certain outcome, the law is irrelevant. The briefs are irrelevant. The arguments are irrelevant. You just work around it. And I think Scalia's dissent points it out in a very simple fashion. And one last point. The whole problem, as Scalia points it out, the whole problem of trying to be guided by unenacted intent is precisely what it's not only constitutionally improper, but it's practically impossible. It's like Heisenberg uncertainty principle. You don't know what it is because it's never been reduced to writing, and the evidence is inherently ambiguous. So we can speculate as to what was the true intent of Congress here. And we'll never finish this debate. So I don't know what evidentiary materials would one bring to bear.
Professor Sadler or Blackman, anything on this point?
No.
Might recall that in
Mr. Rowland, we're going to have to move on. We got quite a few questioners. If you want to join the queue, we might be able to get a follow-up question. But for now, we're going to have to move to our next caller. Thank you.
Hello, Paul Kaminar here. Can you
hear me?
Go
right ahead, Paul. We can
hear
you.
Hey, thanks, Dean. Hi, guys. As you all know, I filed an amicus brief on behalf of 50 members of Congress challenging Obamacare under the Origination Clause. The D.C. Circuit and Fifth Circuit and other briefs were filed by Randy Barnett and Greg Katsas. The D.C. case, we have a cert pending for rehearing en banc that's been there for 7 months. The one in the Fifth Circuit was just filed a few weeks ago. One of these cases will go to the Supreme Court. So my question is, considering today's 6-3 decision, what is the appetite of the court to hear yet another challenge? This one would be a silver bullet, of course, to the case, and get 4 votes to grant cert in any origination clause challenge.
So this is Josh, and as much as I'd love to write another book about Obamacare, I don't think I will. I think the line ends here. The court and Chief Justice Roberts made clear that this is over, that they're trying to get rid of these Obamacare cases, that they don't want to take any more. That John Adler's right, there's going to be litigation around the edges for this and that, but I think the core of the law that could unravel the entire thing, I think the court signaled today by taking this case now and not letting it sit till 2016 is we're through. And the Justice Kennedy in particular, who voted to basically dismantle the ACA in 2012, joined the opinion without any concurrence. So I don't think there's any more appetite for future silver bullet challenges. And I say this with someone who thinks the origination clause has a lot of merit, but I think the court has signaled no mas.
Okay. Thanks.
Jonathan Adler or David Rivkin, anything?
Yeah,
I'm in total accord.
Yeah, I don't get that. I mean, I think that the origination clause ship passed decades ago. While as a matter of original meaning, I think there's a strong argument there. I've never been a big fan of those cases. I agree that the court doesn't want to have a lot of these cases, but that's whistling past the graveyard. I mean, there will be more and more cases, and there will be cases that are filed by organizations that are not seeking to limit or constrain the healthcare law. There will be cases filed by groups seeking to expand it. Immigrant rights groups have talked about suing to expand benefits. Women's rights groups have talked about suing insofar as the administration doesn't adopt interpretations that they want. The way the statute operates and is written, it is a permanent employment act for health law litigators, and it will be so as long as it remains on the books unless Congress reforms it, and there's nothing the Chief Justice can do about it.
Take another call.
Yes, this is Mark Heck from Winnetka, Illinois. I appear pro se, no affiliation whatsoever. To try and turn my comment into a question, let me phrase it this way. What do you say to somebody like me who believes, first, that in terms of logical inconsistency, today's opinion is mild compared to the court's Affordable Care Act decision of 2012, and second, that Chief Justice Roberts deserves some applause, at least, for saying pretty clearly in his final paragraph that what he is doing is politically motivated. And third, that perhaps what Chief Justice Roberts actually has in mind to do, rightly or wrongly, is to avoid the court being subject to the type of massive public opprobrium which came to bear in the 1930s when the Supreme Court was striking down New Deal legislation after New Deal legislation and led to its sudden change in the late 1930s.
Well, briefly, this is David Rifkin. I disagree with you as to which was the more extensive rewrite, but reasonable people can differ. But I would say this. I appreciate your point, and perhaps that's exactly how the Chief Justice is looking at it. It is a very incorrect and dangerous position, I would say this, that the whole reason we have the framers created Article III courts the way they created them is to insulate them from both political pressures and political liabilities. To take the position that despite that you are going to have politicized decisions not driven at all by any rules but are driven by the perceived political stakes and the political pressures is enormously delegitimizing for the court, enormously bad for the separation of powers. And I can see no redeeming virtues. And the last thing I would say is, look, if I were in the Chief Justice's shoes, I would have concluded that enough of his predecessors, going back particularly to Chief Justice Marshall, have invested years and decades and centuries of time to build the court's legitimacy to a point that it is not so fragile that it would crumble because they're taking an unpopular opinion. Take the position that is kind of an overarching decisional imperative, I think is just fundamentally wrong. It makes absolutely no sense. to do it in the year of our Lord 2015. We do it in the, you know, during the first term of the Supreme Court. You know, in the case like Marbury versus Madison, who of course stated the obvious, you know, Mr. Marbury never got his commission. I could see some sail trimming, but not at this point in time.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Rifkin. I can't disagree with you. I can only add that in my humble opinion, this case and the decision in this case was a slam dunk after the 2012 decision and Roberts' opinion in that case. But I'm sure, as you said, people can argue with that, of course.
Let's take still another call.
This is Jack Park. I don't know whether this question will be, it's kind of in the weeds. I'm not sure how this thing works. The majority says that the refundable tax credits are provided in advance directly to the individual's insurer. Does that mean that money's being dispersed by a federal agency that's not coming in terms of taxes, so it's just deficit spending? And was that it scored that way for CBO?
Yes and yes. The incidence of these so-called tax credits is primarily takes the form of direct outlays from the Treasury. These are refundable tax credits, and given the income of most of the folks that are eligible for them, most of these tax credits manifest themselves as direct outlays. That was brought up in the case. The plaintiff's brief pointed out, and I think an amicus actually spent a lot of time on the fact that that's particularly problematic because there's longstanding precedent to suggest that courts should not presume that agencies have the power to make appropriations that Congress has not expressly authorized. And the court, in holding the language is ambiguous, has effectively said it's not clear that Congress meant to authorize these expenditures, but nonetheless we will green light it. Anyway, and the CBO certainly always scored this as not merely a loss in tax revenues for the federal government, but as direct outlays.
Thank you.
Sure.
David Rifkin or Josh Blackman, anything on this point?
No.
No.
All right. We've got two questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Pepper Crutcher, Baldwin Bingham, and ACAreview.com. I've got a question for Professor Adler. 10 days ago in the Baker-Botts bankruptcy fee case, Justice Roberts joined a part of the opinion that Justice Sotomayor refused to join, though she was otherwise in the majority. And in that paragraph, I read these words: "Our unwillingness to soften the import of Congress's chosen words, even if we believe the words lead to a harsh outcome, is longstanding." That's a quote. And then, quote, "Our job is to follow the text, even if doing so will supposedly undercut a basic objective of the statute," close quote. So if you're teaching a course on Justice Roberts' jurisprudence, which is it?
Good question. And if I'm teaching a course on the Chief Justice's jurisprudence, I mean, there's language in NFIB that certainly suggests that as much as possible, any disagreement people have with the way the ACA operates should be handled by Congress and not the courts. But the only way to make that actually happen is if the courts enforce the law as it is actually written, so that it is clear what it is that people object to and what it is Congress should do about it. The Chief hasn't stuck to that either. Certainly some people had hoped that that language indicated how this case would come out. There is similar language in an opinion the Chief Justice joined last term in the Utility Air Regulatory Group opinion. There is similar language in an opinion that Elena Kagan wrote last term in the Bay Mills case. But that is all set aside here. As the Chief Justice says at the end of his opinion, Congress wrote the law to improve health insurance markets, not to harm them, and therefore the law must be interpreted to achieve that result. It's a bizarre notion of statutory interpretation because regulatory policy always involves trade-offs and choices. This law involves trade-offs and choices. There is no – the idea that no matter what the law actually says, we must interpret it to line up with some ephemeral notion of Congress's intent is shocking. For those that haven't read the opinion, just read the last two paragraphs of the chief's opinion. They are remarkable, and they certainly fly in the face of quite a few opinions that the chief justice has signed onto in the past.
Well, in the court, let me just add one sentence, snarky note, that the only way perhaps these days is for Article One to prevail is completely abolish the statute. So the blank slate is not. Something Article 3, even with the court's current tendencies, can do. But God help you if you just tweak it a bit, because then the court would always be able to find, as we've been discussing, that there is some unenacted or overarching intent that they're going to give effect to. So it suggests that statutory abolition is the only path forward to make things safe from judicial rewriting of statutes.
We have a hard stop at the top of the hour, but it looks like we have time for a final question here.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. At the 2008 National Convention, Judge Scalia addressed the Assembly and made a very interesting remark that has not gotten as much attention as it deserves, but that I think illuminates the way, the kind of thinking that may be at play here. When asked a question from the floor whether he would vote to overturn past wrong precedents, he said, "I would have to be crazy to do that." He said it with a great emphasis. I videotaped it. It's on YouTube now, on our YouTube channel. I think we have to ask why he would not only feel that he would have to be crazy, but that he would be so emphatic about it. You know, what is he afraid of? What are they perhaps afraid of to overturn wrong precedents? There may be something going on there that is not apparent in the higher sphere of legal discourse.
Anybody want to take a shot at responding to that?
I honestly have no idea.
Nope. No comment.
Okay. We've got a couple minutes left. Let me give each of you 30, 60 seconds to wrap up, but we do need to stop at the top of the hour. So in the same order we began, Josh Blackman.
Sure. So in closing, I think it's important to stress that the Supreme Court has signaled that indeed Obamacare is not just a law, that it's something bigger than the law, and that this president and future presidents can take whatever steps necessary to avoid any impact on the social safety net this law has actually created. I don't know what this means politically, but I don't think the courts can be viewed as a refuge to stop this lawlessness in the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta.
Jonathan Adler.
Yeah, I don't have any comments that are quite so profound. I just will note one little irony. The Chief Justice says in his opinion here, the statute has to be interpreted in a way that always serves its overarching goal of fixing insurance markets. But yet it was the Chief Justice who, in his NFIB opinion, not only decided that a mandate was a tax, but more significantly decided that new Medicaid and old Medicaid could be severed to cure the unconstitutionality of conditioning receipt of Medicaid money on state cooperation. Of course, a consequence of that has been, as we have seen, many states deciding not to expand Medicaid, and as a result, leaving the most vulnerable and poorest populations in many states without any benefit from the passage of this law. So the Chief Justice has, not only in other statutory interpretation cases, but in his prior Obamacare decision, done the exact opposite of what he said the court is required to do here. What this law is and how it is being interpreted is a moving target, and it's unfortunate to see the Chief Justice do it.
Good points. Picking up on Jonathan's last point, it goes to show that not only Article III courts are constitutionally not meant to rewrite statutes, that they're very poor at it. I guess this is a perfect example of sort of a flip-flop of not appreciating what are the consequences of your rewrite, which, you know, bad enough when Congress does it after a bunch of hearings, but certainly particularly dangerous in this context. And the second point, again, I'm probably most pessimistic of a few of us on this call today. I don't think it's the problem, the rot, if you will, to use a big word, is endemic to Obamacare. I think that any time there is a statute that has great political stakes that impacts a great chunk of our economy and society, again, unless Congress completely takes it off the books, it's going to be constantly revised by the courts. Whenever things are not working well, again, even in a situation where the sitting president is not pressing for it. So the courts going forward will become sort of a legislative drafting colleagues of Congress, in not in every case, but in a number of circumstances. That's a very bad thing.
Well, gentlemen, it's been terrific to have you with us today, as always. I certainly appreciate your insights. I thank you on behalf of the Federalist Society. Thanks also to our audience, and a reminder to check your emails and the Federalist Society's website for teleforum calls that are likely to be scheduled tomorrow and throughout the week next week. But until that next teleforum call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.